Hello, I'm Katie Steckles.
And I'm Peter Ola. And Katie, what's today's mathematical object?
Today's mathematical object is a joke. So this is one of our slightly more abstract notional objects. It's not necessarily a real tangible object that you can hold in your hand unless it is out of a Christmas cracker. But I've brought along, in order to talk about this, a real proper actual comedian. Welcome, Beck Hill.
Hey, hello.
So I thought it'd be nice to talk about jokes and comedy and the fact that there's a lot of, I guess there's a lot of structure in there that people maybe don't realise necessarily is in there, which can be thought of as mathematical in various ways.
Oh, absolutely. Well, because jokes and maths both run on the same concept, which is a pattern, except you go sort of one slightly further with jokes. Actually, I can't say that. I'm not a mathematician. You're probably like, what are you talking about, Beck? We always go further than that. But with a joke, it's not just about finding the pattern. It's about finding the pattern and then changing it. And that's usually where the joke lies and what makes something funny. It's that element of surprise. It's, okay, I see where this is going. Oh, I wasn't expecting that.
Yeah.
And that's why if you've heard a joke, you know, the same joke over and over again, really good jokes, you can kind of a few times because you've forgotten how the pattern breaks and it's a delight to hear it again. But most of the time, after some repetition, you're like, okay, this is now, weirdly, the broken pattern is now the new pattern. And then that becomes boring.
Yeah, well, it's that element of surprise, isn't it, I guess? So if you know what the twist is, then you don't get surprised by it anymore. But yeah, I think because you say, you know, comedians go further and break the pattern, but that is a thing that mathematicians often do as well, right? I guess we're looking for patterns all the time, like that's essentially all we're doing, but we also are interested in the ones where the pattern breaks because that sort of tells you something about the pattern as well.
Yeah,
right? I think yeah, sort of in a mathematical sense, the pattern breaking is an interesting thing that happens. It's not necessarily a good thing. I guess in physics, that's the kind of thing they look for, is like unexpected experimental results, because that tells you something about your theory that you didn't already know, and physicists are already happy to be proved wrong. In maths, we're slightly less happy to be proved wrong in that sense, but it's still, you know, it tells you something more about what you're studying, I guess.
Well, and often you got the really boring patterns are not, or the really predictable patterns are not as interesting. It's like, I'm thinking about like tilings, the tiling where it's just a square and it tiles the plane. It's like, well, all right, that's fine, but that's a bit boring. Whereas the slightly more interesting things going on are, you know, all the tilings that don't quite tile the plane, but they can tile a really big area. There are all sorts of things that are not quite, there is an easy solution that makes a really regular pattern. And then there's something that's got a bit more interesting. Mm.
Oh, absolutely. And I think that's, again, it's the same with jokes, isn't it? Like Christmas cracker jokes generally are not funny because they're easy.
We did a whole episode of mathematical jokes where basically I would say jokes and then, you know, in this sort of voice, and then Katie would go, yep. Right. That is a joke. That is what that is.
You have achieved one unit of joke.
Yes.
But occasionally I would say one that she'd not heard before, and then she bursts out laughing, and that's just this marvellous thing. So many of them are. Yeah, like you say, the pattern, I've heard that one enough times that I'm now, it's fine. That's good. That is a joke.
Yeah.
But that's all you're getting from.
Yeah, and I think it's part of the skill of a comedian, I guess, is to understand the pattern well enough to know how to break it in a way that's going to be funny.
Like, yeah. And I think that's where it gets really tricky, because, and that this is where it differs a lot from maths, is because it's very instinctive. I think you can obviously learn it and get better with it, and that just comes from practice and being able to read an audience and your own delivery and, you know, getting all those things correct. But at the same time, there are people who just get the pattern. I guess there are people like that in maths as well, but they get it immediately and they don't really. There was an amazing comedian, I don't know if he's still performing, but this comedian called Nick Sun from Australia. We have a competition over there called Raw Comedy, which is sort of the Aussie version of So You Think You're Funny over here in the UK. And basically it's a new act comedy competition, and Nick Sun won the Raw Comedy competition in Australia, and if you win that, you get to come over to the UK and automatically go into the final for So You Think You're Funny, or the semi-finals or something. And he was the first He was the first person to win both competitions in the same year, and he did it with a 3-minute set. And he's worth looking up, just Nick Sun, S-U-N is his surname. And he just understood inherently what it was he needed to say in order to set up and break those patterns. But to the point that I saw him absolutely sabotage so many gigs because you could see him winning an audience and being like, well, that was too easy. And then just going, right, let's see how quickly we can lose them and get them back. And it became like a game for him. And it was something that a lot of comedians really like to watch because you'd sort of go and you'd stand at the back and you'd watch him just absolutely, you know, come out with all these fantastic one-liners and really great observational bits and clever reveals. And he had the audience in the palm of his hand, you know, regardless of what type of audience it was. And there'd be a moment, you'd see the switch go in his head and where he just realized it was going too smoothly for him to actually feel like he was gaining anything from it. And he would just stick the microphone in his mouth and then lie on the ground looking up at the ceiling and go, until the audience sort of, they would laugh for a bit, then stop laughing, then start laughing again because they were like, oh, this has now gone ridiculously long. But he would just wait until those laughs slowly died off and he'd just lost the last person. And then he'd stand up and then he'd start to try and win them back. And I don't think I ever saw him not win them back. And it was infuriating. Absolutely infuriating. Are there any mathematicians you know who can do, like, who do stuff like that, who will automatically, I don't know, come out with something and be like, oh, I've created this formula, I've found this, and then break it on purpose and infuriate everyone?
I feel like I'm sort of reminded of, like, Paul Erdős, who's, like, this famous, I guess, maths nomad who existed for an indeterminate amount of time in the past, because I don't know.
This is sort of mid to late 20th century.
Yeah, but he was essentially famous for just wandering around, and he would just turn up at your house if you were a mathematician and go, I'm going to stay here for a few days, and then just hang out and live in your house for a while. And he would just come out with this incredible stuff, like really interesting maths and like interesting questions that he'd just sort of drop, leave lying around, and then just walk off and leave you to answer them or whatever. And I often got the impression that he would sort of just be like, oh, I think I understand this well enough now that it's no longer interesting to me at all, and I'm not even going to bother with it. And, you know, he'd leave those things for other people to finish up and write up and, you know, do all the actual legwork on. But it's that kind of idea of, like, this no longer presents any challenge for me, so therefore I'm going to mess around with it. But I think that's a useful thing, actually. As Peter was saying, if you've got a boring example in maths, you almost try and make it more interesting by breaking it on purpose, right? You just go, well, what happens if I don't do that at all? What happens if I, you know, if this is on the surface of a sphere instead? Or, you know, something changes and, like, that will again tell you something that you didn't already know. So,
yeah. I think going back to the structure stuff as well, obviously, I mean, I know because we've done comedy related gigs together before. So the rule of three is a really common thing. And I'm sure that all your listeners understand it as well. But for any who doesn't, it's just the idea that it's funnier to say something in sort of groups of three.
Yeah.
And I imagine that's somewhat linked to the fact that it tends to take three inputs to create a pattern.
Yeah, I guess you do a thing and then you do another thing that's the same as that, which is enough to establish what the things are that you're doing, and then the third one is something else, and that's funny.
Well, that's not necessarily it, though. Sometimes in writing, it is just the fact that having a list of three things, it feels more whole. But what you're talking about is comic reversal or unexpected ending, which is when you initiate a pattern, and then with the third one you change it, which is almost like a breaking of the pattern. So it's that's when you've that's why right, for instance, knock knock jokes, right? Everyone, you know, I'll give a really classic one. Knock knock,
who's there?
Doctor
who?
He's coming to fight the Daleks, whatever. Right, all of those ones, right? Notice how it didn't get a laugh. That's because you all kind of you could all see where the pattern was going. And it fulfilled the pattern, and you're like, okay, that's it, right? And this is why I think kids are so great, because kids don't recognize that a pattern is necessary. And so because as an adult, you're used to hearing a pattern, when you don't get a pattern, that ends up being funny. So one of my favourite, there's a website called Kids Do Jokes. I think they brought out a book at some point. It was a Tumblr originally. And basically people would just send in the jokes that their kids had written. Sometimes the kids would type them up so you get all the grammatical errors and stuff as well. And one of my favourite ones, it's really dumb, but it was just knock knock.
Who's there?
My penis and butt, right? And it was spelt P-E-N-A-S as well. And obviously this is some kid who's just learned it, who just is like, what's the funniest thing? Genitals, bums, like, yeah, what's not to love, right? But the first time I heard that, I could not stop laughing because, A, it didn't go where I expected. I mean, firstly, you're not expected to then say, who's there? Like, that's the end. Like, it just, there's yep. nothing after knock, knock. But also, secondly, it's the misspelling of penis, yeah. which just absolutely, like, fills me with so much joy, because even that is a breaking of a pattern, because you're expecting it to be spelt correctly and it's not. And so I just think those little things are so delightful. But it's almost like often kids have to learn the pattern to then appreciate the jokes they told as kids once they're adults.
Yeah, I have a live performer of this genre in my 6-year-old, and he's I was just looking if I make little notes of funny things that he says. I've got one here. He said, "What does a lion do if it gets scared?" I said, "I don't know. What does a lion do if it gets scared?" And he says, "Brushes its teeth." And it's because he sort of gets the rhythm of a joke. I can't remember how old he is, probably 4 or 5.
Yeah.
And he sort of understands that there's a call and response thing going on, but he doesn't understand that it has to be funny.
Yeah.
And then he went through a phase where he would like have a funny premise. But so I've got one here where I told him a joke that was, what do you call a dinosaur that sleeps all day? Dinosaurus.
Nice.
And he didn't get it. He laughed, but he didn't get it. So I tried to explain it. And then he said, oh, I've got a joke. What makes bones wriggle? And I said, I don't know what makes bones wriggle. And then he sort of said, oh, I've got to think of the joke bit. I haven't thought of the one for that. he's got a funny concept. So he's going to say that and assume that the joke bit will come to him later. So he doesn't understand that you probably build the joke. And then
I've been to enough open mic nights to say that that's not just children. There is a lot of people out there who assume the funny bit will come and have a horrific moment when they realise it doesn't.
Yeah.
But yeah. What I love as well is that your son's setup, what makes bones wriggle, is, I mean, I couldn't come up with that. No. I'm not, they don't. That's my answer. If they do, you're in trouble.
Yeah. Oh, I was going to say, so back to your threes. I wonder if, because 2 points make a line, right? Make a straight line. So if you've got 2 things, you've got a direction of travel, and then you sort of think you know where you're going, but also it might not be a straight line. It might be something more weird is happening. So I guess the third point reassures you that it's in line with what you would have predicted if you'd, you know, like 2 gives you the direction of travel, and then the third one is like reassuring because it's like, yes, that is, I have understood the first 2 correctly. I'm going the right place. And that's why you can't just do 1 thing like the reversal. I love the terminology and I've forgotten what you said already.
Comic reversal.
Yeah. You can't do that with 2 things because 1 hasn't set up the pattern adequately yet, I guess.
Yes.
Yeah.
That's right. Yeah, generally. And these are all loose as well because there's so many other factors that come in. It's like you're saying, what happens if I put this on a sphere? You could arguably say, what happens if someone else delivers this joke? Or what happens if I say it in a silly voice? What happens if I draw it as a picture and people have to guess? There's so many different ways of doing the same joke. There's you just reminded me when you were talking about the if we were to see jokes as a line, and where a lot of them tend to just become a corner.
Yeah.
A really nice example of repetition in comedy, which is where you are almost creating your line, is Stuart Lee. Does it wonderfully, where he will repeat the same thing, so you start getting the line, and then he'll slightly change it, but then go back to it. And that's where the comedy is. So he might say, you know, sometimes you can say the same thing over and over again. Sometimes you can say the same thing over and over again. Sometimes you can say the same thing over and over again, but change it slightly, but then you want to say it over and over again. And it just, it gives it that little, it's almost like if you're looking at it as a graph, you just have that little bump and then it would go back down again. And I think that's why lovers of, you know, comedy nerds essentially love Stuart Lee, because Stuart Lee has gone one step further than where everyone else goes.
Yeah, and it's lovely because I think he often does that as a way of pointing out that actually the thing that he's saying applies to this other situation as well. Like it's quite often a nice way to like, and you sort of listening and you go, oh yeah, you know, that is, yeah. You know, it makes a point without actually making the point in a really clever way.
Yeah.
Which is dead nice. Because a lot of this stuff, I guess, is about kind of understanding the context and knowing what the structures are that you're working with. Because as you say, anything that is unexpected, you need to be expecting something in order for that to be unexpected. So it's about sort of knowing exactly what people are expecting.
And also it has to be unexpected in the right way.
Oh, absolutely.
Because the lion brushes his teeth. It's just, that doesn't bear any relation to the lion being scared. It needs to be close. In the right sort of area, but surprising enough to be funny, doesn't it?
You
can just say anything. You can't just sort of make it a funny.
I mean, we all laughed.
and actually, this was a huge problem because, of course, he's like a little, reinforcement machine learning system that he says things and you respond and that's how he learns. So when he tells a joke like, you know, what does the lion do if it's scared? It brushes his teeth and everyone laughs. He's like, yep, I understand how to tell jokes.
But that is also because we have that context, isn't it? Again, it's like, what happens if I put this on a sphere? It's like, you've got the context of where it's coming from, who's delivering it, that this might be their first joke, that it's, you don't, also, there's always a thing with kids where you're just like, what are they going to say? Is this going to be awful? Oh, thank goodness, it's just a line brushing its teeth. And so I think, you know, he could have said my penis and butt. Like. Yes. And I think that's, again, it's where that format comes into. I'm going to say my very favorite example of comic reversal or an unexpected ending is it's a Dave Allen sketch. And again, for anyone listening, Dave Allen was an Irish comedian who mainly did a lot of anecdotal stuff mixed up with sketches and stuff like that. Very, very funny. Well worth a YouTube search afterwards. And he had this sketch. So he's dressed up as Frankenstein, Frankenstein's monster. And so you've got Frankenstein, he's in this forest, and there's a little girl playing, you know, by a lake or something, and Frankenstein's monster sees the little girl. And then it cuts to this woman in the forest going, my baby, has anyone seen my baby? And then cuts to, you know, him and the little girl, they're sort of playing and doing that sort of stuff. And then it cuts back to this woman getting really distressed. My baby, where's my baby? Oh. And then it cuts to, you know, him and this little girl just innocently playing. She's showing him some stuff. It's really sweet. And she's like, oh, there's my baby. And she runs over and she picks up the little girl and wraps her in her arms. And then she looks at the camera and she says, okay, hands up. Who thought I was going to pick him? And then, you know, the audience laughs. And then in the background, Frankenstein's monster just sadly raises his hand. And it's just heartbreaking. Because, like, that already, it's a nice twist. It's like we were expecting the twist. Then she subverted it by refusing to do the twist. So that's funny because we're like, oh, I know this is on the graph. This is going to be a corner. And then it goes, what? No, it's a line. And you're like, what? And then somewhere else, this other data point just goes, oh, I thought it was going to be a straight line. Like, I thought it was going to be a corner. And it's just so, like, yeah, I think it's a beautiful example of how you can do a twist on a twist.
Yeah, well, it's that kind of, it's one of the things that people sometimes talk about in kind of communication, in kind of engaging people, I guess, when I'm talking about maths. And one of the ideas was that you can sort of anticipate when people are going to anticipate what you're going to do. So, you know, you do a thing and you're like, actually, you know, you're doing a thing where there is a twist or there's some moment of reveal or whatever, but actually the reveal happens in the minds of the people watching when they realize what it is you're going to do. And that can be a much more powerful kind of engagement for people, like a much more powerful moment when you actually, you know, they are one step ahead of you.
Oh, perfect example, Milton Jones. Half the time, doesn't even finish his joke. And that is because it takes a moment where you recognize the pattern, then see where it's going to go off. And then he realizes you've done it for you. And then he just goes on to the next joke. And the fact that he lets you finish it off is so enjoyable that there's like an extra laugh because everyone's like, oh, he trusts us. And then you get to go on to the next joke. Absolutely.
I guess the craft in it is being able to set it up so that it becomes so obvious what the joke is that, you know, that other people are able to get there as well. But again, that relies on this sort of context and knowing where things are and how things all fit together. Is that thing where being a comedian, you kind of have to either know about everything and do comedy just about everything and the human experience and, you know, whatever's going on, or you get these comedians that sort of specialise, like Matt Parker, who does maths comedy specifically, and it's just sort of within the context that he does jokes, like people know what he's talking about or he does enough explanation to set it up properly. But you can basically take anything that has a sort of predetermined set of ideas around it and use that, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I think there's so much to be said for essentially what sets apart a really, and this is, I mean, I realise that our object for this episode is a joke, but I mean, humour is subjective, so I quite enjoy the juxtaposition with that, or the oxymoron, I should say. But I think there's what makes a comedian very good at being a joke teller is, and a joke writer, is the ability to understand exactly the balance between giving enough information that the audience starts to fulfill the pattern themselves, but not so much that they get there before you want them to.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where timing tends to come in as well, because if you were to tell quite a clever joke but then wait far too long, then it's just going to sort of, everyone's going to slowly come to it on their own thing, and you don't get a group sort of reveal to it. But if you were to tell a joke and leave just enough time that the audience feels like they should have gotten it and then say it, it's just that lovely moment where people are going, oh, or they might have just been on the cusp of getting it, and so it's like you've just nudged them to give them the answer, and then it's that joy of a group effort.
That is lovely. I think also, because you mentioned earlier about reveals, I guess this is a word we keep using, but there's a lot of nice humour that's derived from like adding an extra bit at the end that suddenly reveals that actually the context is entirely not what you were thinking about, and you know, the situation is actually something completely different to what you were expecting based on the sort of description that you've seen. And that in itself is funny because there's probably a really good example.
Oh yeah, well, it's the I don't want to go to school, mum. All the kids make fun of me and they're all bullying me at school and I'm not going. And the mum says, well, you're the head teacher, you have to go. Like that's a really classic. And you've got, there's some really, really nice ones as well that are all essentially joke versions of that riddle about the person whose son is admitted to surgery and they say, oh, I can't operate on this child, it's my son. Yeah. But like the dad was in the car crash and they're like, how does this work? And it's like, well, the surgeon's a woman. And there was a moment where that was mind-blowing for people. And these days it doesn't quite...
Depends on the person.
Doesn't quite have the same effect, thankfully. Yes. Yeah, that's true. Maybe I'm just around too many people.
Well, yeah, it also means that there's a sort of context in terms of when and where you're telling the joke, right? Is sort of knowing your audience a bit, but like now jokes are different to what they were 20 years ago.
Yeah.
I mean, they're probably better, right? We've had more time to practice, so.
Well, that's it. I think my favourite, I've found that over time, I'm not necessarily into the jokes as much as the person. I think for me, it really comes down to whether the person as a whole package of it, the way that they're delivering something is enjoyable, and because I think that's a harder thing to turn into a formula. I mean, if you love comedy, I recommend don't get into it because it's a really good way of ruining all the things you love. Because I grew up, you know, just absolutely devouring stand-up specials. I say specials, I mean, I'm talking about cassette tapes in the family on Family Car journeys and the occasional moments we got stand-ups on TV in Australia. But you just absolutely adore it. And then once you start doing it and you start realizing what it takes to do stuff, it just gets very boring. So I just love people who do things that you can't formulate. There's a comedian called Jos Norris who I adore watching because I can't understand how he thinks. I can't work it out. I can't break it. And I find that very enjoyable.
Yeah, and that's a major difference from, like, in maths and science and all sorts of things, you tend to write in the third person because the idea is, like, you know, I mix these two chemicals together and this thing happened, but if you did it, the same thing would happen. So you write it in the third person. You don't put yourself in it. You know, these two things were mixed and this happened, because that's a universal sort of experience. Whereas what you're talking about is not that at all. And you hear sometimes about comedians who sort of say, oh yeah, I wrote this joke, but it definitely won't work for me.
Absolutely.
Because it doesn't fit with everything else that I'm offering, sort of thing. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. 100%. I've written a lot of puns that work really nice in a deadpan voice, but I really struggle to be deadpan, because if I tell a joke that gets a good laugh, I'm going to laugh at it. Like, I'm so proud of myself. I will laugh on stage. But yeah, then some of my favorite comedians are ones who don't ever laugh. I don't know how they do it. Why do it? Why would you do it if you're not happy?
Yeah.
I love that you're saying that you write about it in chemistry and maths. You write about stuff in the third person. And I guess I was trying to think, because a lot of stand-up is very much done in the first person. Because as soon as it's a lot of the time, and I am generalizing because it depends on the type of comedy you're talking about, but a lot of the time it's the person telling you about thoughts that they've had or experiences they've had. And as soon as you're telling it about someone else, it then becomes a story, and then it starts to blur the line between whether you're a storyteller or a comedian. And there's a Venn diagram as well, because there's a lot of people that fit into it, where you get some people who tell some fantastic stories about things that have happened to, you know, people they know or strangers they've met or things like that. But if they did that all the time and then didn't ever talk about anything from the first person, it becomes very clinical, methodical, which is, I guess, what you need in science and maths, but in comedy makes it far more theatrical, which is not a bad thing, but is it stand-up? I don't know. We'll ask your listeners. Write in to at, I forgot what the Twitter handle is.
Yeah, we're all about definitions in maths, right? We need precise definitions of everything, so but I think it's, as you say, some people kind of have this natural knack for being able to make things funny, but I guess there always will be these sort of underlying structures and kind of patterns in the ways that jokes work and the ways that comedy sort of falls that kind of underlie it all, I guess. I don't know. I feel like that's quite a philosophical point, that sort of, you know, comedy has this hidden beat to it, I guess.
Well, I think, it's about what the perceiver, I guess, about what the context of that person is as well. So you could hit the formula for a joke, but whether it's funny depends on the context of who's hearing it. Because if there's someone who watches using Stuart Lee for example, if you've never seen stand-up before, you might be like, why is this guy repeating himself a lot? I don't understand. If you watch a lot of comedy, you might go, oh, I see what he's done there, that's very clever, you know. And I guess it's the same with maths and science. Is it, you know, you might have someone who's like, oh wow, 2 + 2 = 4, that makes sense. And then you've got other people who are like, oh my gosh, this is so basic. Give me something juicy. So there's another type, which we've kind of sort of done in a way, which is deconstruction. Because we've been talking about the structure of jokes. We haven't actually said whether it makes them funny. It's just about whether it's a joke. And then you get into the whole, like, mind, you know, stuffing up your mind about whether a good joke means that it's a funny joke or whether it's a good formula. Because many a time I found myself nodding along to some comedy going, that's very good. Not laughing once, but being like, this is very, very good. And I wonder if there's anything to be said, because with deconstruction, you have to obviously understand certain rules of comedy. There is a wonderful example of deconstruction by a comedian called Marek Larwood. And in fact, I saw him try this out at a new material thing. It might have, he was in a sketch group called We Are Clang, and he still does a lot of other stuff. But he had, I'm not going to do this justice, but he had a bit where he would basically, he was saying he was going to be doing a big TV gig, and he was very excited about doing it. But he hadn't written the jokes yet, but he still wanted to rehearse his segment. So he comes on, he's got his full suit and everything. And he bursts onto the stage really, really confident. And he's like, I'm smiling and thanking the audience. I'm thanking you. Oh, going to point at you because someone talked to you earlier. Yes, they did. I'm referring to that bit. Okay, and I'm going to talk over here and uh-oh. I don't know if that's a good look from you. Are you sad? What? And then, like, he would just start explaining, like, a Live at the Apollo style set. And then he'd be like, you know, here's a story about my child. And wait for it. I'm just going to put on a bit of a serious voice for a moment, because I want you to think that actually there is a bit more to me than just the smiles and the comedy. And I'm just going to let you follow me for a little bit. I go a little bit quieter, because actually that makes you want to listen in more. So I'll just go a little bit quieter and I'll take you to this deep moment. And then I'm going to turn it around with a really dumb thing. There you go. You thought you knew where that was going. And it was just such an enjoyable, you know, it is like seeing the algebra for a set. It was so enjoyable. And I think you have to have seen enough of those TV spots, you know, those sets to really understand why what he was doing was so funny. But I just remember thinking, yeah, he's actually written the entire formula for a Live at the Apollo set. And all you, it'd be like Mad Libs. All you'd have to do is like fill in the blanks, you know?
Yeah, I guess a lot of that stuff ends up being quite formulaic, because TV producers just go for what they know is going to work, and they're just like, oh, we can't do anything too experimental on here. But I guess the comedy scene is full of people doing literally anything and everything you can imagine, right? There's,
oh, yeah. Yeah.
Anything goes, really. At the Edinburgh Fringe, certainly, you find someone in a cupboard somewhere in Edinburgh.
I mean, to be fair, I'm in a cupboard right now, so everyone is willing to explore what does work and doesn't. But ultimately, when it comes down to it, it's patterns.
So where can people find you online? I mean, or on other podcasts? I notice you've recently doubled your output of your your own podcast.
Oh, yes. Yeah. So I do a podcast with some nerd no one's heard of called Matt Parker. It's called A Problem Squared. It's where our listeners send us problems and we try and solve them. I try and solve them. Matt does solve them. So that's really fun. So you can find that on any of your podcast listening apps. And I also am on social media. Oh, I've got a book coming out. I should plug that, actually. 28th of April, the second in my series of books called Horror Heights. Second book's coming out. It's for ages 8+. I'm saying 8+ because anyone listening can read it. You don't have to be a child. I've written it for me and I've made them child friendly. That's how I'm pitching them. But they are the horror sort of horror-y, Black Mirror-y type books. So the second one's called Now Live Screaming. And it's about a kid who wants to be a streamer. So that's on 28th of April. You can find me on social media, Instagram, Twitter, all of that, at Beck Hill Comedian. Yeah, just Beck Hill Comedian. Or Beach Hill Comedian if you read it wrong.
Reasonable. Excellent. We are also on Twitter. I am at Stex.
I'm at Peter Ollett. The podcast itself is at Maths Objects. We both blog at a website called aperiodical.com, where you can find more episodes of this podcast.
And if you have any thoughts or any jokes or any ideas about this or other episodes of the podcast, you're very welcome to email us objects@aperiodical.com.
The music is Funky Game Loop by Kevin MacLeod, licensed under Creative Commons.